Morning, I want to open by telling you a story of Joy Davidman. Joy Davidman, you may know, was the wife of C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis is a famous Christian apologist. And Joy Davidman is much less known than her husband, but she was a brilliant woman. She was Ivy League educated. She was a prolific author. She was educated and grew up in New York in the 20th century. She would later marry a man named Bill Gresham. Mr. Gresham was an alcoholic. He was abusive. And the two had two sons together. They would later divorce. And Joy was left with the kids and with her occupation as a writer. And as a writer, she was barely able to make ends meet. So during this difficult time, Joy was converted to the Christian faith. She got a hold of C.S. Lewis's letters. She became very fond of them, and she heard that if you begin writing C.S. Lewis letters, he will actually write you back. So the two had a 2.5-year letter-writing relationship. But even though she had been converted, even though she had this the best of pen pals, she had a nervous breakdown. The unusual stress of child rearing and tight finances took their toll. A family member noticed and offered to watch the boys for an extended period of time so that Joy could wrap up some writing projects and become healthy. And so she did. She moved to London. She finished some writing projects. And while there, she decided to meet her longtime pen pal. So she meets C.S. Lewis, and C.S. Lewis lived with his brother Warren, and Warren and C.S. Lewis began a great relationship with Mrs. Davidman. So she decided to stay. She came back, she got her two boys, and they went back to England. They lived there for 2 more years. Things went really well. C.S. Lewis gave her a job helping edit and type his work. And they dined with the Lewis brothers frequently, and they celebrated major holidays. But the relationship was completely platonic. They were just friends. They were just co-workers. But Joy Davidman had, like many young intellectuals during this time, got involved with the Communist Party. Right after graduate school, for a very short stint, it was at arm's length distance, but the British government would not renew her visa once they found this out. So now she had to go back with her boys closer to their abusive father when things had been going so well for them. So C.S. Lewis decides to marry her. It's just a civic arrangement. They still live separately. They still work together. But it just allowed her to stay in England. But their relationship would change in a most unexpected and surprising way. See, Joy got very sick with cancer. It looked like she just had a few days to live. With her and C.S. Lewis, they wanted to get married in the eyes of the church. Part of the reason they wanted to get married in the eyes of the church is because during this bout with cancer, their marriage had transformed from something that was merely civil to a love relationship. It was in the state of suffering that their love was kindled. Their love was transformed from something that was a mere formality into something vibrant. Not by a great rush of Hollywood romance, but through struggle and through pain. You might be wondering what this story has to do with you. It might have a lot. Because many of us, we need our formal, abstract way of relating to God to be transformed into something real. And that's only going to happen through suffering. So this morning, we're going to look at this man named Jacob. I'm going to come at this passage by asking 3 questions. Where are we blessed? How are we blessed? And what is the blessing? So in other words, what's the context? Or the context, the means, and the result. So let's start with where are we blessed? The context, both in the book of Genesis and in Jacob's life. The book of Genesis, as many of you may know, is organized according to its main character, We start out with Adam. Then we move to Noah. Then Abraham. Then Isaac. Then Jacob. And lastly, Joseph. So Jacob's story is tied in very closely with those who precede him and the one who succeeds him. See, Abraham's Jacob's grandfather. But his more famous claim to history is that Abraham is the one who received the promise from God that his family would save the world. Abraham's lineage would be the river which carries redemption to the earth. So the remainder of the book of Genesis, it contains the threats of God fulfilling that promise and how God, in many surprising ways, rescues his people. The threats are from without and from within. Those from without include the fact that when Abraham receives this promise, he's married to an old, barren woman. Another threat from without is that he's called by God to sacrifice his own son, the son of promise, Isaac. But then there are threats within. Abraham, in a weak moment, doesn't believe that God can create life in his old barren wife's womb. So he gets his maidservant, Hagar, pregnant. It was a character flaw. Abraham, later, he lies about the identity of his wife, saying that she is his sister. He does this, he lies to a foreign king for his own protection. And then we see Isaac, the son of Abraham, he does the exact same thing. But see, this is true for us too. See, we are children of Abraham, and that we have received the same blessing as the covenant people of God. We have received the promise, but we also undergo the assaults, the threats to our faith. And they come from without, from within too. Our threats from without, the external threats, they're death and disease, fractured relationships, and injustice. But they're internal threats. See, the writers of the Old Testament, they seem to go out of their way to smear the reputations of those with whom God is covenanted with. So instead of hiding their flaws or naming them ambiguously, the authors put them right out in the open. They put them right out in the open next to their dignity. So often we're left with very complex characters. Abraham, for instance, he has good days, and Abraham has bad days. Jacob is an anomaly. He's much less complex. He only has bad days. See, his name means schemer, cheater. His name throughout the narrative reflects his character, both as Jacob and later as Israel. See, Jacob is a twin when he receives his name, and his twin brother's name is Esau. And when they were born, Jacob was holding on to Esau's heel. So the word for heel grabber is also the word for cheater, which is Jacob. It makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? Having your Achilles heel ruptured renders you lame in the same way that being cheated renders you lame through life. So throughout the Jacob cycle in Genesis, Jacob's ways match the meaning of his name. He cheats his way into the inheritance of the firstborn son. His older brother Esau was only older than him by seconds, maybe minutes. They're twins. So Jacob, when he gets this birthright, when he gets the inheritance, as you can imagine, Esau is furious. He threatens to kill him. Jacob, in fear, moves to a far-off land with his uncle. This land is called Paran. And there, we see Jacob, his family flourishes. He has two wives and 11 children. His wealth flourishes as well. It's not really his wealth, it's his uncle's, Laban's. And Laban becomes exceedingly wealthy as his livestock and his herds increase. So that leaves Jacob. He wants to be independent. His family's large. He's a skilled manager. So he wants to go back to his family's country, into Canaan. But when he leaves, he wants some of Laban's wealth. After all, Laban's only wealthy because of Jacob's skill. But instead of this acquisition being honest, his acquisition of Laban's wealth is deceptive. So this point in our story, we see that Jacob's enemies are Esau and Laban. Or at least that's what we would think. But Jacob's greatest enemy is not Esau or Laban. It is himself. See, Jacob spends his life up to this point purely focused on the horizontal. He wanted pleasure that comes from women. He wanted to be successful in his career. And he wanted the security that comes from being rich. But his vertical relationship with God was never more than an afterthought up to this night. He knew about God. He cried out to God in crisis. But that's the depth of his relationship with God. It was shallow. His experience of God was weak. Somehow the light bulb never went off for him. He had heard about God all his days. He would say that the God who covenanted with his grandfather was his God. He would say that. But his character was off. What would be the fix? The fix would be found on the verge of impending doom. He would be alone, and it would be at night. See, this night of impending doom, it comes after 20 years of being apart from Esau. The last time Esau wanted to kill him. But now he gets word that Esau is on his way to meet him. So we've got Jacob traveling from Paran, Esau traveling from Canaan, and they're going to meet in the middle. When he finds out that they're going to meet, Jacob does what he always does. He schemes. He schemes by sending a messenger ahead of him to Esau. When he sends his messenger there, he's got a message for him. It's got three parts. Let me give it to you. Here it is. I have been waiting with Laban, or I've been staying with Laban, and have remained there till now. You know what Jacob really means? He means I have not been hiding or avoiding you or sneaking behind your back. Second part of the message, I have cattle and donkeys. Implication, I'm not coming to try to take anything from you. I have plenty. Last part of his message is, I am sending this message that I might find favor in your eyes. In other words, can we let bygones be bygones, forget the past, and start over? But see, when Esau receives this message, he's stone-faced. The messengers report nothing back to Jacob but this. Esau is with 400 men. So Jacob still doesn't know how Esau is going to greet him. In verse 7 of chapter 32 says that Jacob is greatly afraid and he is distressed. So Jacob comes up with another scheme. His scheme is that he's going to send three waves of his family and his servants and his herds. So that way, when they come in waves, and if Esau decides to attack, he's only going to get part of Jacob's estate. Another plot might be that he's going to wear Esau down with three waves. By the time he encounters three waves, he'll be impressed, therefore manipulated, and then Jacob shows up at the end. But even though he has this plan, his fears are front and center. The distress of meeting with Esau has Jacob in a place of need. And this is right where God wants him. A place of dependency. So that's impending doom. Now he's going to meet him at night. You got Jacob laying there, sweating with fear. Yet if we were to recount those seasons in which we were sweating with fear, I'd venture to say your story would include that that's where real faith was born. There's something about nocturnal seasons that gives our faith authenticity. See, the night's filled with intensifying anxiety. There's a lack of control at night because we cannot see what is just ahead. So the chances for a surprise, they're heightened. Jacob is frightened that Esau might come up on him and destroy him. Lastly, where does God bless him? Blesses him alone, when he's alone. See, Jacob is without the comforts of protection or possessions. He's alone, utterly alone. The Lord is ready for Jacob to return to Canaan, but Jacob can't go in as he is. The character flaw that must be resolved, it goes much deeper. The rabbit hole goes much deeper than his inclination to manipulate and deceive. Jacob's real problem is that he's self-sufficient. He thinks he has enough resources in and of himself to live his life. So here at the river of Jabbok, God finds Jacob in a situation where his self-sufficiency is crumbling. And brothers and sisters, this is where God must have you. God wants to meet you personally so that your faith is more than cultural, or civic, or social. See, some of us, we've grown up in church with Christian parents. You cognitively understand much of the Bible's message. Your behavior even seems to be Christian. And even though this is true, you may not be converted. You may be a confessing Christian. You may be a cultural Christian. And this has gone on, and now you find yourself as an adult. See, to you, God is simply an abstraction. Jonathan Edwards, the 18th century revivalist of New England, one of his great tasks as a pastor in New England at that time was to decipher who was a confessing Christian, who was a real Christian, who was an authentic Christian. And he gives this illustration about honey. He says, "I can tell you that honey is sweet because I have heard that it was sweet. But it's possible that you don't truly believe honey is sweet because you've never tasted it firsthand." What he's saying is that a relationship with God can be at a cognitive level, but we don't know God experientially. But there could be another instance where faith eludes you. Faith could be eluding you because you've been around the Christian faith all your life. It could also elude you because you're in a new season. You're in a new season where you're a part of a college ministry, or you're a young adult here at this church. And for the first time, church has become relevant to you. If you come here, this is your first exposure, you find the music to be excellent. Maybe not mine, my teaching, but Robert's to be very moving. And then you move away. The music doesn't move you. The preaching isn't as helpful. So you disengage from the Christian community. But what's happened is that you've done what the person who's grown up in church all their life has done. You simply followed the crowd. So to make your faith personal, here's what God must do. He must have you alone. See, God will not tolerate us keeping him as an abstraction. So here we have Jacob. And Jacob is alone. It's at night. And it's the night before impending doom. And things get worse. God jumps on his back. So how does God bless us? He blesses us in suffering. Question number two. So to the modern reader, it's difficult to see just how exactly God blesses Jacob in this episode. It seems like Jacob is receiving his just desert for being a lifelong scumbag. Yet this all-night wrestling match with God that results in the disjointing of his hip is exactly how God blesses him. How could this be? Jacob had been looking for blessing his whole life, and for the most part, between his work ethic and his scheming, he was blessed. Yet he still had not appropriated the blessing of God to his life. His soul was thirsty despite his success. Does this sound like you this morning? Do you have all that you ever thought you would need, yet you're still empty on the inside? If so, know that God might just jump on your back. Let's look at this God who jumped on his back. Verse 24. You'll see that this wrestler is simply identified as a man. But if we look at some of the other details that the narrative gives us, we find that this is not a mere man. Here are some of the clues the narrator gives us. This man has the power to change Jacob's name. This man has unusual strength. It says he just touches his hip. Now, there could have been another word chosen that could mean strike. That means to touch with great aggression. And that would be what disjointed his hip. See, there's an orthopedic surgeon who's a member of our church, and I found him in the parking lot last week knowing that this was going to be my text. And so I said, Dr. Christensen, what would it take to have your hip disjointed? And he said, extreme force. Like falling from multiple stories of a building, falling from a great height. That would disjoint your hip. Another way that your hip would be disjointed is in a high-speed crash where your knee would jam against the front of your car and knock your hip out of socket. See, your hip is tied in with lots of muscle and tendons. And the only way it could come out of socket is with unusual strength. And this man, with a mere touch, knocks his hip out of socket. This man refuses to be seen in the day. This man has the authority to bless. But then maybe the biggest clue is found right there in verse 30. Verse 30 says, Jacob names the place Peniel, for I have seen God face to face, and yet my life was delivered. Jacob had struggled with God, and he prevailed. But did he really? See, this unnamed man, he's not injured. But Jacob endured this excruciating pain. How could Jacob be blessed and afflicted simultaneously? Listen to the Psalms that Spencer read earlier. Let me just read them to you. These are all in Psalm 119. It says this, "This is my comfort in my affliction, that your promises give me life. Before I was afflicted, I went astray. But now, I keep your word. It is good for me that I was afflicted, that I might learn your statutes." Do you see how positively the psalmist views his affliction? It seems odd that he would view his suffering so positively. But when prosperity is the air we breathe, affliction is rejected. Perhaps, friends, the crisis in your life needs to be interpreted differently. Perhaps the situation, the person, the ailment that you have been praying that God will resolve is actually God Himself. Not only will God not allow us to view Him as an abstraction, He will not tolerate our narcissism. Our suffering is oftentimes the painful grace God uses to address our narcissism. So what about you? What are you wrestling with these days? How might God reinterpret your suffering? So that's how we're blessed. The last point, what is the blessing? What is the blessing? We have to be careful to say the suffering isn't the blessing. The blessing is God. And it results in Jacob's transformation. The rest of the narrative, we see Jacob's transformation. We see it on a horizontal level and on a vertical level. On the horizontal level, chapter 33, the account of Jacob's actual encounter with his brother Esau. Jacob's a new man. Now, on the vertical axis, he's different too. See, when Jacob, after he meets Esau, he gets to Canaan. When he gets to Canaan, he builds an altar, and he names the altar this, El Elohei Israel. El Elohei Israel. It means God, the God of Israel. Now, when we hear Israel, we think of a nation, or Old Testament people, they thought of a people. But Israel here, this is Jacob's new name. Jacob is saying, this God has now become my God. Friends, this transformed life, it's the evidence, it's the litmus test of true faith. When Jesus becomes personal to you, the result is not modified behavior. It's transformation. You may have come this morning thinking that you needed some behavior modification. That's why you're here. You acknowledge the need for change, but you're unmotivated to change. See, behavior modification is done from a position of strength. I can fix this habit, I can fix this person, or I can fix this institution. Yet God will not come to the aid of the self-sufficient. Our self-sufficiency must dissolve completely. And that's when God said, "This is what I've been waiting for." But perhaps self-sufficiency is not your issue this morning. Perhaps it's vanity, greed, bitterness. But all of us who have embraced the gospel as the basic storyline of our lives, we are in the middle of our own sanctification. In other words, God will wrestle with you for the rest of your life to make you into his image. So what needs to be wrestled out of you? Perhaps God will wrestle you into loving your coworkers and out of using them as leverage for your career advancement. Perhaps God will wrestle you out of your fits of rage towards your children and into a patient posture of service. Perhaps God will wrestle you out of your chosen isolation, where you hide your insecurities and your addictions, and he wrestles you into gospel community. Perhaps God will wrestle you out of your obsession with yourself and your family image and into the security of beloved sons and daughters. But the question still remains for us this morning. How are we going to move from reframing our suffering from self-pity, excuses, and bitterness, and attributing it to God's loving hand in our lives? How is that going to happen? Who wins the match? It's a trick question. They both did. Jacob gets the blessing. God gives a blessing that he wants to give. But why did God have to wrestle with Jacob and not just show up on the scene and bless him? Let me ask it personally. Why can't God reform your character without struggle? It's because we have to wrestle to learn things. When Jacob says, "I will not let you go until you bless me," here's what he's really saying. Everything else in my life up to this point has not worked. I'm desperate for your blessing. This is really a cry of repentance. So Jacob wins through weakness. But God also wins. See, God got Jacob just how he wanted him. Dependent. However, God did not achieve his victory by obliterating Jacob. He won by becoming voluntarily weak. Look at verse 25. It says that this man could not prevail against Jacob. But think about it. Two wrestlers, when they wrestle one another, they have to be of similar weight. God and Jacob. How much does omnipotence weigh? How much does God weigh? Friends, God became voluntarily weak. But how could a God of justice, bless such an immoral person such as Jacob? Let me tell you, in the middle of the night, God chose to wrestle with an evil man in order to bless him. But in the darkness of Calvary, Jesus chose to take our sin and the punishment due us so that he might bless us. Jesus became voluntarily weak. In fact, he was not just weak, he was crushed. He died. And the justice that should have fallen on Jacob and on us came down on Jesus. See, Jacob held on at the risk of his life so that he could get the blessing.